much for coming to this event at the beginning of the inspiring Boston Book Festival, and thanks to Chloe and everybody else who made it possible. This is an hour-ish for reading poems and thinking about poems, our own and others from the past and present, that use personae, in which we pretend to be not ourselves, to be a character from some other work of art, a cartoon character, a Shakespearean character, a character from myth, a flower, an airplane, a piece of concrete flooring, a cloud, who knows. We are going to think about why we do that as poets, why others do that, and what resources are available in the use of personae that are not available in other kinds of poems, and also that are not available in longer works that use characters in other ways, in drama and television and the novel. We are going to start with some poems heard by each of the three poets up here, counting, I'm afraid, myself, and then we will have a conversation interspersed with the reading of further poems, and we might have some time, I believe we'll have some time for questions, should questions arise. I'm going to introduce Sandra, and I'm going to introduce Jessica, and then we're going to hear from them, and then I'll read some poems, and then we will have our conversation. So I believe we're having Jessica, and then Sandra, and then I will read. Is that right?
That'll be fine.
Yeah. So Jessica Bozak, who lives in Boston and is from Massachusetts, and has lived not only here, but in Poland and Russia, right?
Russia, Spain, Costa Rica.
Russia and Spain and Costa Rica, and has worked in translation and comparative literary studies in addition to the writing of poetry, is the author of The Body Feel Lexicon, a terrific first book out from Switchback, in which a series of characters, personages, creators in a nested series of fictions write to each other as wolf and as leopard, and write to each other in tiny fragments and in expansive prose poems. I think we're going to hear some of both, and I think we're going to hear some brand new work. Jessica has taught at the New England Art Institute and currently teaches at Boston University. She also runs a tremendous reading series in Cambridge for emerging poets, poets who will be very well known very soon, called the Small Animal Project. And I encourage you to check out this year's Small Animal Project lineup, which is smallanimalproject.com?
Yes.
smallanimalproject.com. And Sandra Beasley, who has come to us from Washington, D.C., is from that area. She attended the University of Virginia and American University, and is the author of two books of poems, Theories of Falling, from 2008, and I believe we're going to hear some poems from this new book, I Was the Jukebox, published by Norton, it won the Barnard New Women Poets Prize, and it is a tremendous book, exceptional, I think, in recent years in its ability to combine a kind of casual, inviting vivacity with a tremendous formal intelligence and formal skill. Sandra is also the author of a brand new memoir called Don't Kill the Birthday Girl, out from Crown, and it thinks about food allergies and many other topics. But she's here today as a poet. We're going to hear from Jessica, and we're going to hear from Sandra, and then I will read you some persona poems of my own, and then we'll have a conversation. Thanks.
Thank you all for coming. I think I'll read a couple of the letter prose poems followed by a couple of the more fragmented poems. Dear Leo, scent marks, a greater range of vocalizations, these will be new. How right to be at the top of a food chain, to have 42 teeth, instead of the 6 I was born to lack, to live in harmony with a group. In the winter, my tail will keep me warm. Ingenious, the rounding up of self, the animal coiling. Moving ahead into it, sometimes slowly, sometimes greedily, I sneeze and wait for the moment I'll lose my human frame of reference, when memory will be scent and seasonal, when movement will be fast and fur hard. But I'm scared to lose. What do studies say about the lupine subconscious? What can they say about ours? We can't tap a hole in the side of a head, stick a milkshake straw in, and simply film. What if I went to, at first, a circle of drive-in screens, and then a walking into and out of worlds? Not the tundra, not instinctual, wolf. My fur ruse. To prevent my running away in daydreams, I needed to be tied up. My idea. I like to struggle against the dirty rope. I like to get free. I should have recognized that life would always be topography built up to be leveled. The reconstructions were similar. Sometimes a ceiling fan stood in for an air conditioner, but my poorly shaven Adam's apple remained. My strong fingernails tore still at the binds. My fading shoulder freckles kept right on fading. When my spots come in, come to me, your whelp. Exhibit 8A. To proceed, I will clench the sequence between molars and trail pups to sky, the long asked to lose for a song. Look at it catch in the updrafts, for months hide behind snow. Exhibit 8B. Months behind look and tween molars, I snow to draft a sequence for sky. Long up pups, hide song, trail in the clench. Thank you.
Let's see if it's, is it feeding back in the audience or is it just back here? Okay.
Okay, so do you want us to use this mic or just rely on the... Okay. So may I just stay here then? Or do you want me to come up to this mic? I want to hide. Good morning, everybody. My name is Sandra Beasley, and I'm going to share a trio of poems from I Was the Jukebox before we switch back, hear from Stephen, and then switch to the conversation. But I wanted to introduce these poems just by mentioning that, you know, my first book, Theories of Falling, I will often describe those as my heart poems of sorts. And they were, in many ways, received in autobiographical spirit, which was wonderful, but I also felt this tremendous need to kind of push away from the self in my second collection. So I found that I wanted to maintain kind of the potency and the energy of an I voice, that there were certain things that I really couldn't describe or get at from third person, but how to do that and yet to occupy personae truly not my own. So each of the poems that I'm going to read kind of demonstrates a different facet of the self outside the self that I wanted to explore. I'll start by reading a poem called The Piano Speaks, and it was the idea of how can I occupy inanimate points of view. The epigraph of the poem says, after Eric Satie, and in particular I was thinking, how would a piano that for years perhaps had sat dusty and unused in the corner of a parlor, as many pianos in households tend to be, how would it feel after it had been played not only by somebody accomplished, but someone, a master such as the composer Satie? The piano speaks, after Eric Satie. For an hour, I forgot my fat self, my neurotic innards, my addiction to alignment. For an hour, I forgot my fear of rain. For an hour, I was a salamander, shimmying through the kelp in search of shore, and under his fingers, the notes slid loose from my belly in a long jelly rope of eggs that took root in the mud. And what would hatch, I did not know. A lie, a waltz, an apostle of glass. For an hour, I stood on two legs and ran. For an hour, I panted and galloped. For an hour, I was a maple tree, and under the summer of his fingers, the notes seeded and winged away in the clutch of small, elegant helicopters. The second poem is occupying the perspective of an unlikable character. In a sense, I'm following in Robert Browning's footsteps. The Minotaur speaks. The queen lay in the hollow of a wooden cow, so my father would mount her, his white hide glistening like a raw moon. To love is to look up, up, up. She named me Asterius, the starry one. When the king heard my birth cry, he raised black curtains to every window in Crete. He began to build. My father was led away by a rope around his neck. My mother gave me the apple of her breast, and I bit it off. To love is to feed and feed again. My room has 32 walls, no doors, no chair, no light, no mirror. I touch a face that is leather and horns and mine, mine, mine. They say this man has flaxen hair, a mouth so fine the gods beg him to speak. They say my death will make him a hero. Everyone loves a hero, but a hero only loves you until he reaches the next island. This is my only island. To love is to unwind the long thread of your heart and at the end tie a noose. Love, come and get me. And the third poem that I'll read, and as you might notice, there's a kind of parallel in the titling of these, is called The Platypus Speaks. And what it gets at, it uses a form called the sestina, and a kind of thumbnail description of the form is that in your first stanza, you commit to 6 end words, which then have to be repeated in a very precise pattern over a subsequent set of 5 stanzas and then a final envoy. So it's kind of a jigsaw puzzle of form, an acrobatic form. And what I found was that those intense repetitions meant that it was a form ideally suited to internal monologue. And I really think, you know, often when we think of things to ourselves, when we're obsessing or complaining, we do kind of return to the same terminology or the same imagery again and again and again. And so the fun thing about writing sestinas for me has been that they've tended to spin off into these kind of crazy persona voices. In this case, it's in the voice of not just a platypus, but a mama platypus, and not just a mama platypus, but a very cranky mama platypus. All my platypus facts are true. The platypus speaks. As far as duck-billed platypus goes, I'd like to point out there's no other kind of platypus. You don't say horse-hooved deer or moth-winged butterfly. A beast should be her own best description. I deserve that, having survived 100,000 years of, you would make a fine-looking hat. Years take their toll, the right ovary that goes on the fritz every time, flat feet and that tangled mess of our sex, 10 different kinds of X, Y, and yeah, blind dates tend to be a disaster. We're no sluts like the deer, though, June through October only, my dear. Then we build deeper burrows for the year, each dirt plug a form of daycare. To be a mom must suck, or so the saying goes, except we've got no teats, only a kind of belly gully where milk pools so that the platypups can lap it up. Take that, Disney. Bambi's mother was never a dear daiquiri. Take a particular kind of woman to do that for 7 years, twins every time, while the deadbeat dad goes back to his bachelor pad. He must be so satisfied, lazy as a queen bee, stroking his only weapons, hind spurs that barnacled to his ankles. Out he goes with enough venom to kill angry deer, but would he save me from hunters? No. Years teach me not to expect a card, a kind Mother's Day word, or flowers of any kind. There's no alimony in the wild. Beware. Even minor developments take years. But evolution's crawl has its perks. That way I track electric waves, swift as deer, swiveling to go as the hot shrimp goes, each soul spark a kind of beacon. If that makes me a bad guy, Disney, be a deer and live all my years. You'll see how it goes. Thank you.
I never get tired of that platypus. There is, I feel like I'm in my Morning Jacket album. There's very echoey back here. It's kind of great, but it does do some things to the words. Is it super echoey where you are? It's better up front into the sides? What? It's okay. Better up front than to the sides. I'm going to try something. Is this better? Is this better? Pretty much we're in a room that's got a lot of reverb in the room no matter what you do with the microphone, so we're just going to go with it. And I won't yell. Okay, thank you all for coming. What a privilege it is to hear these two different kinds of poetic impersonation, and I'm going to read you another one, or maybe a few more, and then we'll talk about it. I'll read one poem from Parallel Play, one of my own books, which came out a couple of years ago. And I'll read a couple from Belmont, my next book, which really is called Belmont, and will be after the place in The Merchant of Venice, where the lovers flee, and that'll be out in 2013. Self-portrait as Muppet. Beleaguered administrators everywhere, I am one of you. I came from a swamp, too. It was hard to get out, even harder to be young and green and try to please children, but hardest of all to learn how to run the whole show. I nevertheless remain, supposedly in sole charge of a dance marathon, a masochistic acrobat, a pig addicted to lipstick who holds black belts in several martial arts, a talking shag rug 8 feet tall, a bear who tries and tries and fails to entertain, a pantomime horse whose parts refuse to leave their day-glow yard, a rock band, and a Pepto-Bismol-colored pair of cows from Mars who only know one song, Mana Mana, whatever that means. I need a rest. I sigh. I sag. I shrug in my canvas chair and perk up again to chat with tonight's special guest who asks me why my eyes bug out. Go figure. I used to sit on a wall all day and read the news. Now we go on in 10, and I am happy to tell you what almost anyone who seems to be running things will say once you catch us backstage. Somebody bigger than we can ever get is pulling the strings. I was hoping to get some tie-in with the forthcoming Muppet movie for that one, but no one has contacted me from their production. If you know anyone at Muppet Labs. Let's see. Sandra read. I'm going to save the other pop culture impersonations for later if you guys want them. Sandra read a poem in which the platypus argues that butterflies should not be known as moth-winged, which is true. Where is that one? The Atlas moth is the biggest moth in the world. An atlas of the Atlas moth. Now I am an adult, and I will never eat again. All the weight and elaboration that took in a morsel of anything save air and sex have fallen away and remain in my soft cocoon, whose lost array of silk will last longer than I do. In Taiwan, a girl can take it to market, pin ribbons on it, and fill it with a few brass coins. As for me, saturnine, spread out and almost immobile as long as the sun shines, I am host to a fleet of sparkles, slightly awry, divided in half by my own body. I can bide my time on any leaf or parked car's hood till lights outdoors grow cool and breeze sends me again down into my slow glide in search of a mate. There are parts of me that anyone can see through, transparency like mica. Transparency like mica occupies my awkward fourfold wings. I am nearly hollow. Wind, love, and oblivion veer up and down, and I follow. Since we've had wolves and leopards and a platypus, I think one more animal. We have two cats at home, and before we moved here, we had more, and this poem is spoken, unfortunately, by one of our cats who is no longer around. Cleo, nights I feel safe in your house, when the bit of thin air the television leaves us threatens to cross my path, and the nimble gray mate with whom I share a food supply and a pillar of rattan and dross chases me out of my corner. I announce my presence on or near your sleeping head. I am the self-propelled soft eminence you knew before that strange and easily led man came to share you with me. I have known the black cloud of which you have lately complained, being myself a short black cloud, and though I can neither pounce on evanescent dejection nor bury a rough, insistent memory, I do announce some hope in my fur-lined fur undercoat's silver lining. I can lie flat like a seal or curl up like a bear. A sudden, severe, if never quite silent, presence at cuttings of meat or openings of fish, I race to assure or prove to you that strength of appetite persists in the absence of comfort, that some pleasure may be seized even by those of us who cannot leap very far off the ground or do more than growl at keys in the door or far-off car alarms. Though I see nothing I need be afraid of, still I hate to be picked up, will scowl and bellow and tether myself with one claw to cushion or rail. Yet pad in ballad rhythms across your pillow and try at length to start each day in your arms. Thank you so much. So let's have a conversation, and we can bring in questions if there are questions from those of you who are hanging out here listening to us. And I hope that we will discuss other poets, but also have the chance, all of us, to read a couple more of our own poems. And why don't I start by asking the same question first to Jessica and then to Sandra, which is, what do personae, what do named, specified, obviously not you, because perhaps not human, or perhaps just a character, What do personae let you do in poetry that you couldn't do without them?
So before I answer that, I just want to say that those of you who are familiar with Sestinas were probably really impressed by Sandra's because those end words just disappeared right into the sentences.
Yeah.
Thank you.
In bad Sestinas, you really know what's coming because the poet has wrenched the language out of shape to get all those six end words in. And one of the ways that you know you're in the presence of a certain kind of really good one is that you can't tell it's a Sestina until you're almost all the way through because it just sounds like the words belong there anyway. And that was terrific, yeah.
Well, I think, not that I want you to answer, but just coming directly off of that, what I'll say is that, you know, to me, that particular form has a bad rap as being an incredibly artificial form, and it is in some ways, but the reason why I think it works so well for the persona poems or dramatic internal monologues is that I really do think that when we worry to ourselves over something, if you just factor out language for a minute, think about the last time you really worried about a job or a lover. Don't think about the words you use to articulate it. Think about in your head. We repeat and we repeat and we repeat and we come back to these same ideas. And once I realized that, it kind of made the Sestina a lot less intimidating to me and is why I choose it so often. We were talking last night about the next collection, and for me, I'm writing poems that in some ways are about love, and there's one Sestina that's about an emperor who keeps trying to woo his beloved queen who's freezing him out in the bedroom, and he does so by sending her animals, more and more and more animals, and he starts off by saying, perhaps the monkeys were overkill, you know, and so, but it kind of works with that idea of just returning again and again to these repetitive attempts to solve the same problem.
So. Was that in Black Warrior Review?
It was, a while ago.
If you have a chance to order back issues of the Alabama-based Lit Mag Black Warrior Review, you can see some more of Sandra's Sestinas, including that one.
But now I'm
Yeah.
Okay, so the persona poem, I think for me, is so much about identity, but I'm not very interested in writing about myself in any kind of overt way, and I think that's probably because I also keep a journal, and so I sort of keep that stuff in the journal and maybe explore the kind of ideas in my poems. And this first book for me was so much about the relationship between these two characters, how they exist together and also how they might come to exist apart from each other. And so each of the poems is in a sense a kind of catalog of the transformation that they're sort of writing or scripting for each other.
Can you say more about who those characters, Wolf and Leopard, who they are and how they came to be present to you? Because they are a through line in that book. They animate everything.
Yeah, I was actually the kind of short, or there are maybe two answers, and they're not connected in any way. One was that I loved Mattia Harvey's first book, Pity the Bathtub,
its forced embrace of the human form.
Right, and my ex-boyfriend dreamed a response to one of my favorite poems in that book, and I was so envious, like I wanted to have that dream. And so I think that this book originated as my attempt to sort of compete with his dream. And then there was Lucy...
Did you win?
I think so, right? There's the book. And then there was, in terms of the sort of language origin, there's a Lucy Brock Broido poem that referred to a dire wolf.
It's in the Master Letters.
Is it in the Master Letters? Yeah, and so I was kind of thinking about that too. And you've written a lot about Lucy Brock Broido and the Master Letters, more articulately than I could talk about it.
Should we move on to thinking about Lucy Brock Broido's work as an example? Has she been important to you as well, or not so much?
Not as much. She wasn't reinforced. You know, one of the other things we came up last night is this idea that every kind of Atlantic, every area has its own people who get reinforced. I wasn't ever asked to really read her or study her in depth as much. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, certainly the Southern tradition of writing has a lot of persona poems and kind of inhabited voices, and so, but, so I won't take that ball and run with it, but.
I'm going to ask you to in a minute.
Okay.
Lucy Brock-Broido, for those of you who don't know, has three books and a fourth on the way, and all three of these books have sustained acts of impersonation that are not realistic, that are not casual, that are not chatty, that are not, as let's say Robert Browning's dramatic monologues are, meant to have us imagine a person or a talking leopard on stage, but rather shift in and out of the language that would have been used by Emily Dickinson, by a baby trapped in a well, by this from her first book, Manute Bol, the, I believe he's deceased now, former Washington Bullets interior player who is super tall and from Sudan. Who else is in, by the Brontes?
The little boy who survived the MOVE firebombing in Philadelphia,
right,
in 1985.
Birdie Africa.
Yeah,
it's also
Birdie
in
Africa.
Her first book. And then her most recent book, which is called Trouble in Mind, which is a much darker and in some ways more grown-up book for good and bad, has a series of sonnets called Self-Portrait as This, Self-Portrait as That, and they are very painterly. They almost become descriptions of Baroque or Rococo works of art. And so she showed, reading her made me think, and I think, Jessica, maybe helped you think, about how to do an impersonation that did not have to be realistic, but could go back and forth between the costume and the mysteries of the character that the poet can become.
Well, so, I guess what I would, just two twin points. One is, since I did open up the Pandora's box of regionalism, I would just say that for a lot of the Virginia writers, who I attended the University of Virginia as an undergraduate and studied poetry there, and then ultimately went to American University, and I've grown up in Virginia. What interests me is that a lot of the persona poems written and kind of most popular are, in a sense, almost as much inspired by fiction as they are by earlier generations of poets, and so they tend to have a heavy emphasis on narrative. I mean, Claudia Emerson's Pinion, which was one of the books that she wrote before Late Wife, which won the Pulitzer, is really this very Faulkner-esque story told in three parts that belong to different characters in this small claustrophobic family, almost, long, long poems. One thing that interests me with persona poems is that sometimes a subsequent generation loses the fact that the poems were originally written in a persona voice. I feel like that has happened, for example, sometimes with Langston Hughes. People read his work and they don't get that he's adopting a persona. They just think he's talking in the slang of the day, you know. One person who I really admire in terms of adopting a life and a perspective outside her own is Gwendolyn Brooks in the amazing sonnet series Gay Chaps at the Bar, which draws upon the experience of African-American soldiers in World War II. So that's just another couple of out-of-left-field examples of persona poems.
Yeah, Brooks also is someone where you have to tell your students that just because the poet is Black American and the speaker is a Black American, they're not necessarily the same person.
Yep.
Although with those sonnets, it's so clear that they are men who have served in a war and fought and then come back, and that there's less danger that people will think that they are Brooks. Mm-hmm. Should we read more poems and then keep talking? Jessica, why don't you read? Do you want to read another new one?
We can also ask if there are questions, too.
This is a good... why don't we read a poem each and then stop for questions and then keep chatting? I want to hear another new one of yours.
Okay.
Selfishly, perhaps.
So, the new project, I think, is a pretty different take on persona, and I guess that's because... step back. It's in a way... self-portrait as a record of thinking about the things that I've encountered. So I'm going to read a poem that comes from a talk I heard by the Japanese architect Shigeru Ban. The Architect's Tale. There's a dishonesty in rebuilding. I would have made a shelter from thick paper tubes, insulated with what scraps we could find, a thick plastic tarpaulin stretched tight across the top, a true refugee structure, one that wouldn't attempt to persuade the lone survivor that he is living the same life, that wouldn't remind him, by its empty chairs, clothes in the closets, and water bowl on the floor.
On the floor.
In Being the Morning panel, we get to work out all the kinks in terms of the sound and technology. So now, when you see later events scheduled here today, you'll be like, oh, I know exactly what they've fixed by then. It'll be great. I'll read one of the Speaks poems. It's another one that speaks in the voice of something inanimate. It's the opening poem of the collection. It's called The Sand Speaks. And this was an interesting exercise in trying to write from a voice of plurality. For those who don't know, sand is not actually a particular type of matter. Sand is a size. So anything can qualify as sand under the right circumstances. And I was interested in writing a poem that spoke to what the perceived experience of the material would be like. I found myself flashing back to those images you see from all the war movies of soldiers storming the shores of a beach. The sand speaks. I'm fluid and omnivorous, the casual kiss. I'll knock up your oysters. I'll eat your diamonds. I'm a mutt, no one thing at all, just the size that counts. And if your animal small enough, come. If you're vegetable small enough, come. If you're mineral small enough, come. Mothers, brush me from the hands of your children. Lovers, shake me from the cuffs of your pants. Draw a line, make it my mouth. I'll name your country. I'm a yes man at heart. Let's play hide and go drown. Let's play pearls for his eyes. When the men fall, I like the way their arms touch, their legs touch. There are always more men who bring bags big enough to hold each other. A man who kneels down with a smaller bag, cups and pours, as if I could prove anything. When I was working with a translator who was moving the poem into German, and he got all of the obscure references that I was worried he wouldn't get, except for the fact that he didn't know what to knock up meant. So I had to explain to the German translator, well, we have this thing in the States. No, it doesn't involve hitting people in the head. That was what he thought it meant.
No. I was going to go with the talking stapler, and then I was going to go with a tween pop star, both of whom are in the new book. But instead, I'm going to give you a poem spoken by one of the better gifts that our older son received when he turned, I think, 3. And the name of the gift is the name of the poem, First Astronomy Globe, and the globe. Incapable of glowing under my own light, I spin instead. I do my best work when you're in bed, either quiet and wide-eyed, or else asleep and unknowing. And though I have an infinite supply of darkness and silence, I let it all go by, preferring not to scare you with the void. I cut up my space into parts, and the parts fit into stories. The boy who grew a giant fin, for example, and others that you made up. The anteater's tail. The trapezoid you named the cellular phone. Absurd or anachronistic, but no more so than the camel, the hunter's belt and torso, the dog star, the giant ladle, the lesser whale, a cross to light the flags of southerly nations. A wise young gazer will memorize not just the names from made-up constellations, those dotted lines, those rules religions trace, but the ranks of the stars themselves. Coming close to my face, the attentive child past his bedtime sees dim numbers that connect the faintest dots to their glow-in-the-dark parameters, the plots that cut my sphere into right angles, minutes, and degrees. He finds in that firmament no sign of human intent, not even to ask what we are doing here. Say again what an honor it is to be reading and talking with Sandra and with Jessica and to be here at the Boston Book Festival, and thanks to everybody who's making the technology and the organization run. And I should remind you also to purchase the Body Fill Lexicon and I Was the Jukebox when we're all done, but we're not all done yet. We have time for questions, right?
I'm glad you tagged that on, because I think it's important to understand that, yes, I do have an instinct to anthropomorphize as the poet speaker behind the mask of whatever else, but I'm also incredibly aware that the reader will, on the other hand, feel that strong instinct to anthropomorphize. I think that, you know, I guess that's part of why my poems tend to drive creatures in the direction of their dark sides, so to speak, because it's kind of counterbalances. Usually when we talk about anthropomorphizing things, it's usually moving it towards the warm and fuzzy, you know, and like, oh, you know, often in the animal world we say, oh, it's cute, as it's biting the head off of its mate, you know, and it's just, I don't worry too much about an ethical responsibility in the same way that I might with some of the treatment of other human characters in the poem. Maybe in essence I'm trying to liberate myself from worrying about the feelings of the subjects a little bit. Is that helpful, or is there, that gets at it a little bit? Yeah.
I want to pick up on the word liberate, because it's not just animals that do that. I think when we're writing in obvious personae, when it's not just an I or a she or a he or a we, who may or may not be the poet, but it's someone who's obviously not the poet because it's Christopher Marlowe or it's Kevin Garnett or it's a porcupine or it's a Ford Pinto. If you write a poem that says, I blow up at people, this, I haven't written such a poem. If you write a poem that says, I blow up at people, I have a real problem exploding all the time, and there's no indication of who's talking, then there's a certain kind of moral fear and a fear of exposure that can contaminate or kill the poem. But if you write a poem called The Ford Pinto Speaks, and it says, I blow up all the time, then you're sort of protected, because it's obviously not you, and there's an element of humor. And you can then say things that are more interesting and more honest and maybe more aesthetically successful and also more complicated about how anger works. And you're protected, because after all, it's a talking Ford Pinto. And I think there's some of that in your platypus poem.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's some of that in when I write in persona. And I've noticed that when I write in persona, I feel like I'm more able to try to be funny, and I think those are connected.
Yeah. Do you have?
Wait, I want to hear Jessica. Did you have something to say about animals and anthropomorphization first?
Well, I'll say that I think it's definitely a danger, and like Sandra, I think I tend towards the darker side because it seems a little more honest.
Thank you.
first. I mean, I would say I'm okay. That's
can
what
you repeat
that's,
the oh, question?
Yeah,
repeat
that's
the question.
What I was. Oh, I'll
you
repeat
the question.
Repeat the question. Thank you. I believe. Oh, do you want to ask again quickly, and I'll repeat it so I don't get it wrong. Do you find that you're identifying with the characters and really writing about yourself in a way anyway? Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say in the new manuscript, you know, there are poems about architecture, poems about memorial, poems about seismology, poems about atrocity, and those are essentially my attempts to kind of come to terms with those things. And so I think in terms of method for me, this book is, and this might sound obvious, but something akin to Joseph Cornell's method, right? You know, if you know about Cornell, he lived in Queens with his mother and brother for his entire life. He worked as a kind of low-level salesman and textile designer, and yet the content of his boxes and collages was, you know, Russian ballerinas, starlets, Emily Dickinson. And so he didn't have exactly a firsthand experience of that subject matter, and yet he was kind of able to render a personal experience, right?
Yeah, yeah. Writing in personae is a form of collecting. You can take something that's out there. Browning took his figures from history. Lucy Brock Broido gets her figures from popular culture and from distant history. And you can say, here's something that's already been pre-made. I'm going to cut it up and remake it so that it's mine, rather than starting, as it were, from scratch in the manner of other sorts of painters.
And in terms of the personal, you know, seeping in, even when they are ostensibly personae poems, there are some interesting moments like that. I don't need that. Yeah. Don't worry about it. And, you know, like, there's one reference to in my first collection, Theories of Falling, there's a poem that deals with a character, and actually, since I've written about him in straight-out nonfiction as well, I'll simply say that he's a real person who I essentially lost in my life because I lost him to heroin, essentially. And in Theories of Falling, he's introduced as a character who a very first-person voice is engaged with. Now, I know that in I Was the Jukebox, in the poem The Eggplant Speaks, that is a poem that's filled with notions of riddling. The eggplant of the title, it's spoken in the voice of an eggplant. The eggplant of the title is one of the characters in this riddle. And there's a joke in the book, in the poem, that is, you know, it's a bartender joke. It's an eggplant walks into a bar. And I know that the bartender in that joke is the same as the bartender from that poem in Theories of Falling, and it's the same as the bartender that I wrote about for the Washington Post. You know, but it's interesting how I don't know if somebody coming to that persona poem would get that, and quite frankly, I don't even know if it matters, but I'll be honest about it. You're flipping through it, try.
Well, it's a poem that is itself very concerned about how it is taken. This mm-hmm. talking eggplant really wants not to be misinterpreted.
It's a pressing concern among the vegetable community. Don't make no mistake.
Okra doesn't seem to have as much of a problem as eggplant. I don't know why. Was there one more question? In the back of the room. Okay, I'm going to rephrase that also. Are persona poems more popular now because of changes in the way that we think about confessional poetry?
I think you rephrased it in a way that tells us what your answer probably is.
No, I don't know what the answer is. I think it's a really terrific question. And it makes me think about the way that somebody like the poet A.I., wrote poems that were viewed at once as confessional, They had the structure of confessional poems that moved through the speaker's psychic life to the source of deep wounds, and personae. They obviously weren't her. Some of Frank Bidart's work is impersonating and confessional also. I think it's a really good question. I don't know the answer. How are the two kinds of poetry related? Are they related? I think they are. I think they can be.
Do you want to take that?
Go ahead.
Well, I'll just say, I teach seminars sometimes that are occupied with the strategic poet, and one of the things that I mention is the fact that some of the poems in I Was the Jukebox were workshopped under different titles or were originally drafted under different titles. Part of the reason why I shifted the titlings of the poems into parallel, and I have Osiris Speaks, The Minotaur Speaks, The Piano Speaks, was that even though I had always thought of them as persona poems, people were very quick, if there was any I voice at all, to try to make it a confessional poem of some sort. Now, they would acknowledge the incredibly surreal imagery, but they'd say something like, oh, it's interesting how the eye feels compelled to use that metaphor to view herself. So I think that one of the things that I wonder about is whether what we're seeing are poets who are determined to have their persona poems received as persona poems and are making the necessary decisions on like a manuscript level to make that happen. A lot of people in the world on the end of like judging things talk about how many books are now being shaped as projects of sort, where you know maybe something on the back flap or in the title tips you off to receive this as a collection of persona poems.
Yeah, for me, maybe a distinction between a confessional poem and a persona poem is the overtness of the persona poem's fiction. Right? It may be based in fact, but it's more concerned with truth.
If you're writing a poem that has a psychoanalytic model of self-revelation where you tell people what you're really about by showing your deepest wound in a quasi-narrative way, which is as good a definition of confessional poetry as I can come up with in about 2 seconds, then you're committed to that as the truth about you. But maybe there is no one truth about you. Maybe there are 20 truths about you, and they all feel important, and you want to make them all into poems that seem like revelations, and they are mutually contradictory. One way to do that is to try and write as abstractly as possible and write poems that have no first-person pronouns. Another way to do that is to write in persona. When you feel round and bouncy, you can write a poem where a basketball speaks. And when you feel wiry and sad and immobile, you can write a poem in which a Giacometti speaks. And they're both the truth about you. And then you may find yourself having to give them titles so that make clear that that's what's happening, lest people come to you and say, you know, I don't think of you as immobile or as spherical, which I think has maybe happened to all of us who've read persona poems without labeling them in real time. That astronomy globe poem, the first time I read it, I didn't say, the globe speaks the poem. And I got questions about it afterwards where people thought it was a human child speaking or a parent. But of course, it really is a parent speaking, really. We've got time for one more question unless Chloe says we don't.
Short one.
The question is, do we think of our persona poems as portraits, either self-portraits or some other sort of portraiture?
I would say that I do sort of consider the poems a series of portraits. In this new manuscript, which still doesn't have a title, Each poem is titled the so-and-so's tale, so the lone survivor's tale, the architect's tale, the therapist's tale, the public relations consultant's tale, etc. And each figure, character, is essentially a vehicle for either revealing or obscuring the same narrative. And cumulatively, you know, they tell a story, but a slippery one.
I can think of a few examples in I Was the Jukebox where the poem is technically spoken in the voice of a minor figure immediately adjacent to a much more kind of intense figure, that one woman who goes on a date with a dead Greek warrior, another person who's acting as the translator for a famous person. And I think in those cases, those poems really, I had to occupy a persona. I had to shift outside my personal eye to get access to create a portrait of someone else who I was interested in describing. So I definitely think it's possible. It's, you know, so I'm gonna stop there, but we can talk about it more after because I wanna keep time.
Yeah. Are we out of time or is that clock fast?
Yeah.
That sounds great. I believe that we're all supposed to sit down behind you and sign books. Is that right? Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
What a privilege. What a pleasure.